This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Sixth Wedding, written by Ellen Hildebrand, read by Aaron Bennett. What are we talking about in 2023? Home robots, life on planet B20, the resurgence of appointment television, an NFL team in Paris, a phone battery that holds a charge for 1 year, the Hamptons submarine, Elon Musk's moon colony, an 8 billion sensor economy, and the end of the pandemic. Social distancing, quarantining, PCR and antigen tests, masks and PPE are in our collective rearview mirror. We can gather once again. 20,000 people pack into Madison Square Garden to hear Billy Joel segue from My Life into a cover of 10th Avenue Freezeout. Super Bowl 57 is held in Glendale, Arizona. And those who don't have tickets crowd around the bar at Kimmy's on the Greenway. Movie theaters are packed, people do the electric slide at weddings, and Viking River Cruises has a 3-year wait list. Every treadmill at Orange Theory Fitness in Boca Raton is spoken for. All Peloton classes in both New York and LA are sold out. The late night Jimmys perform their monologues in front of a live studio audience. The Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs is at 95% occupancy, and there's no hope for getting a ticket to a Boston Pops Christmas performance unless you want to pay $5,000 on StubHub. Bingo night at Chi Point Senior Living in Milwaukee is back on every Wednesday at 6 p.m. We all go to have our teeth cleaned, our eyes checked. The theme of the Met Ball is Fashion Returns. People get dressed up, wear heels. The impossible-to-get item is no longer toilet paper. It's a seat on Alitalia's Friday night flight from JFK to Rome. The online dating scene rebounds with a fervor. People are meeting IRL, with newcomer Firepink leading the way for Gen X and boomers. The Dow soars over 40,000. And we thought the 1920s were roaring. Although we are relieved that life is getting back to normal, we have returned to our offices and in-person meetings, we're throwing away our ring lights, if we never Zoom again, it will be too soon, we have all learned some valuable lessons, and not just how to make sourdough bread. We have learned to save and budget for the unexpected. We have learned to cherish all the things we temporarily lost. Baseball games, author tours, Disney World, family reunions, charity benefits, college visits, college period, our sense of taste and smell, acoustic night at Frayed Edge Coffee, sitting next to a stranger on a bus or at a bar, seeing one another smile, and most especially, the opportunity to hug our loved ones wherever we want, whenever we want. We honor the ones we have lost. What are we talking about in 2023? We are talking about our shared grief. We are talking about our collective gratitude. Cooper. In the summer of 2023, Cooper Blessing is 56 years old. And when he gets down on one knee on the sidewalk in front of the Red Star Bar and Grill in Fells Point, he's momentarily concerned that he'll need help getting back up. But he'll worry about that in a minute. "Stacy," he says, prying the ring box open. The ring is a 1.75-carat ruby flanked by 1-carat oval diamonds set in platinum. Cooper bought the ring at Market Street Diamonds, which was where he bought rings for wives number 1 and 4, but those had been diamonds only. The ruby is something new. It's Stacy's birthstone. "Will you marry me?" Stacy Patterson's eyes widen. The people who are gathered outside the Red Star, couples dining at the cafe tables, people in line for the bar, an older gentleman out walking his Pomeranian, turn to stare. Stacy takes the ring box and snaps it shut. "Let's go to the car," she says, and she offers Cooper a hand. They're parked in the lot across Wolf Street. The walk there is like an extended free fall. Cooper and Stacy have had a wonderful evening. The Red Star has been their place for the past 8 months. The hostesses, bartenders, and waitstaff know them by name. They had drinks and dinner, and they danced to the live band, Purple Porpoise, until they were sweaty and breathless, making Cooper feel like he was 22 again, a senior at Johns Hopkins out on a date with his Goucher girlfriend. He's wise enough to keep his mouth shut until they reach Stacy's car, a sleek silver Audi A4. Stacy appreciates fine automobiles, one of the many things Cooper loves about her. When they climb in, Stacy cranks the air conditioning, which is a relief. The Baltimore night is hot, sticky, foul. "I'm not going to marry you, Cooper."
"You're not?"
he says. He closes his eyes and tries to let the cool air soothe him. How did he misread this? At the risk of sounding sappy, he thought this would be his storybook ending. Cooper first saw Stacy Patterson 37 years earlier at a party in the basement of the Phi Gamma Delta house. It was early September, the first week of school. Cooper had the robust confidence of a sophomore, and he was finally in a position to chat up the freshman women from Goucher. They had all ignored him the year before. He picked Stacy like he was cutting the prettiest bloom off a rosebush. Stacy had long, dark hair, and she was wearing a yellow sundress. The other women in her cluster were in jean shorts, one in short overalls, reminding Cooper of his younger sister Mallory, who intentionally dressed to distress. Cooper's parents, Senior and Kitty, were formal people who believed in good grooming and first impressions. As enthusiastically as Mallory rejected these values, Cooper embraced them. He admired not only Stacy's dress, but her pearl earrings, her sandals, her French manicure. She was put together. Cooper walked right up to Stacy and offered his hand and a smile, thinking how delighted Kitty would be when Cooper brought this young woman home. Cooper and Stacy had dated for 3 years until Cooper graduated from Hopkins, moved to Washington, where he'd scored a prestigious job with the Brookings Institution, and decided that he had outgrown his college girlfriend. Stacy wasn't quite as upset as Cooper thought she might be. Because she'd been dating Cooper since her freshman year, she hadn't had the full college experience, she told him. The breakup would be good for them both, she said. What she meant, it turned out, was that she wanted to date other people, starting with the captain of the Hopkins lacrosse team.
Okay, fine, Cooper thought. Good for Stacy. He could meet women at any one of the trillion bars in Georgetown. The problem was that Cooper was back to being a freshman at adult life. And the women that Cooper met at Clyde's and the Tombs were clerking for this judge, interning for that senator, researching those initiatives at the NIH, and they intimidated him. More often than Cooper would have guessed, when he got home from the bars at night, he called Stacy. Sometimes she answered, sometimes she didn't. Cooper and Stacy got back together briefly, 10 years later, when Cooper was home in Baltimore for Christmas, and Stacy, still single, was working as VP of marketing at the Baltimore Aquarium. That interlude fell between Cooper's first and second marriages, and although Stacy had been eager to get more serious, Cooper was hesitant, though why he can't recall, and he'd stopped calling. Stacy, meanwhile, married one of the marine biologists at the aquarium and had 2 children, first a daughter, Amanda, and 5 years later a son, Alec. Stacy and her family lived in Ellicott City,
the kids went to parochial school, and husband and wife presumably commuted to work together. Cooper received a Christmas card every year, the tasteful kind with carefully curated photos, skiing in the Poconos, on the beach in Rehoboth, and he thought, okay, fine. Good for Stacy. This past Christmas, however, the card included only pictures of Stacy and the kids. The husband, Lars, wasn't mentioned. A quick check of Facebook confirmed that Stacy was, once again, single. At that point, Cooper had been divorced from Amy for nearly 3 years. He couldn't call Stacy fast enough. And they had been together ever since, nearly 8 months. They were happy, he thought. They joked all the time about how their relationship was the best use of Facebook. No one would ever forget your birthday again, but that didn't hold a candle to reuniting with your old flame. You've been married 5 times, Stacy says now, and divorced 5 times. I love you, but you're a bad bet. And although I have some unflattering qualities, stupidity isn't one of them. The quickest way to put an end to this relationship is to get married. Coop opens the ring box. The ruby is the color of a bleeding heart. But I like being married, Coop says. You don't, though, Stacy says. You failed at it. 5 times, Coop. That isn't normal.
Maybe the 6th time is the charm, Cooper says.
He's trying for levity. Stacy has a great sense of humor. She's fun. She's smart and secure. She gets it. It being the world, life, in a way that none of his wives did, and Cooper wants to grow old with her. They can take Viking River cruises, drive an RV across America, watch Jeopardy, learn to play bridge. Stacy starts the car. There's something wrong with you, Coop. And I was mistaken before. The quickest way to put an end to this relationship is to propose on the sidewalk like that.
That was impulsive. I'm sorry, Coop says. What if I start over privately, here and now? Please, Stacy, will you marry me?
No, she says, as she feeds their parking stub into the greedy mouth of the machine at the exit. The barrier rises. I'm sorry, but no. There's something wrong with you, Coop. Stacy Patterson had the courage to state what no one else would. All his life, people have been telling Cooper he's an old soul. He's been here before. He was born with an ease, an understanding. Who was the first person to tell him this? His mother? A teacher? Jerry Gladstone from across the street? Well, whoever it was did Cooper a great disservice. He'd always trusted his instincts, even after they turned out to be wrong again and again and again and again and again. Cooper's most recent ex-wife, Amy, is a psychologist in the district, and in order to find someone who isn't a close colleague of Amy's, Cooper has to look in Northern Virginia, Fairfax, as it turns out, where he makes an appointment with a woman named Dr. Theron Robb. Whereas Amy is known as a touchy-feely therapist, Dr. Robb is cool and reserved. Cooper appreciates this. He doesn't need someone to empathize with him. He needs someone to tell him what's broken and how to fix it. Dr. Robb is in her late 40s, Cooper would guess. She's tall, black, and as slender and graceful as a ballerina. But Cooper must think of his therapist as a person, not a woman. You lost your parents in a tragic car accident in 2013 and your sister to cancer in 2020. You've been divorced 5 times. Dr. Robb pauses. That's a lot of loss. Cooper nods. It's no wonder you proposed to Stacy, Dr. Robb says. I'm sure you were driven by a primal instinct for permanence. Someone who would stay.
Maybe, Coop says. I'm not completely alone. My nephew Link is living with me this summer, doing an internship at Brookings. We're close.
But he'll go on to have his own life, Dr. Robb says. He won't be with you forever. True. Cooper doesn't like to think about this. Link is the only family he has left, and Cooper loves the kid like a son, always has. Why did your marriages end? Dr. Robb asks.
Various reasons, Coop says. Sometimes it was them, sometimes me. The most recent divorce was me. I wanted out.
Dr. Robb studies Cooper frankly from behind her glasses. He would love to know what she's thinking. When was the last time you were happy? She asks. When was the last time things felt right? Can you take me back there?
I'm not completely obtuse, Coop says. I've given this exact question a lot of thought. The mistake started on Nantucket Island in 1993.
Dr. Robb laughs, startled. I hadn't anticipated that kind of archaeological dig, but I'm game. What happened on Nantucket in 1993?
I left my own bachelor weekend, Coop says. My sister Mallory was cool enough to invite me and my two best friends to visit her over Labor Day. And then she had her best friend from growing up come as well, so there were five of us around the dinner table. I can remember when we all hoisted our glasses, thinking how lucky I was. That moment was golden.
Coop sighs.
Then, later that night, my fiancé, Crystal, called to demand that I come home. She was jealous, she was threatened.
Controlling, Dr. Robb says.
And I left, Cooper says. I abandoned my sister. I abandoned my friends. But most of all, I abandoned myself.
Dr. Robb nods.
So, I guess if I could go back to any point, I would choose that night.
I see.
A bunch of things happened that weekend after I left, Cooper says. Crazy stuff, like from a novel or a movie. And I set them all in motion by leaving. If I had stayed on Nantucket in 1993 instead of going home, my sister's life, my friend Jake's life, and my friend Frey's life all would have been different.
That's a pretty big statement, Dr. Robb says.
I know, Cooper says. But it's true.
He drops his head into his hands.
I can't tell you how many times I've wished I could go back and do it over.
Ursula. On Sunday evenings, Ursula stops working long enough to make two phone calls, the first to her daughter, Bess, and the second to her ex-husband, Jake McLeod. This is what passes for Ursula's family life these days. Bess lives in Washington, D.C., at the Sedgwick in DuPont Circle, just like Ursula herself did 30 years earlier. She works for the National Council of Nonprofits, an umbrella organization that consults with and advises nonprofits across the country, and it's her dream job. Bess has always wanted to save the world and empower the disenfranchised. And in this job, she doesn't have to choose between the homeless and hungry children. She helps everyone who's in need. Ursula sends Bess money for rent and living expenses. And if and when Bess decides she wants to go to law school, Ursula will pay for that as well.
How was your week, sweetie? Ursula asks.
Long, Bess says. I'm working with the Red Cross on their national campaign.
That sounds exciting, Ursula says.
The director basically offered me a job, Bess says.
I'm not surprised, Ursula says.
More likely than Bess going to law school will be one of the nonprofits she's working with snapping her up as executive director. She has always been more like Jake than Ursula.
Did you do anything fun this weekend?
I had a date Friday night with some guy who works for the Nature Conservancy, Bess says. I had to spend 2 hours pretending to be outdoorsy while he described climbing Denali. It was painful.
D.C. is filled with men, sweetheart, Ursula says. Find yourself a hot young lobbyist.
I am not dating a lobbyist, Bess says. But you're right, those guys are the hottest. Honestly, It's like hotness and social conscience are inversely proportionate. Except for your father, Ursula says, a do-gooder and hot. Ew, Mom, please. You're still so young, Ursula says. You should wait at least another 5 years before... I know, Bess says. How was your weekend, Mama? Did the great UDG do anything fun? Depose the bagel guy, maybe? Ursula smiles. She's standing at the floor-to-ceiling windows in her living room that overlook Central Park. She feels like she could dip her toe in the Bethesda fountain. She's still in her running shorts and Lululemon tank, both damp with sweat. She did 4 laps around the reservoir as soon as the beastly heat of the day eased a bit. I went for a run in the park, Ursula says, so I'm feeling very outdoorsy. And I'm going to order up from Maria after I talk to Dad. The lobster and burrata salad. I've been thinking about it all day. You should start dating too, Mama, Bess says. I can make you a profile on Firepink? That's the new one for olders. Ha, Ursula says. Every man in this country already knows my profile. That's what happens when you run for president. You lose your mystique on the dating apps. Bess laughs. I love you, Mama. I love you too, baby, Ursula says. Talk next week. They hang up, and Ursula stays at the window, watching the sky turn purple, and tries to judge how Bess sounds. A bit too much like Ursula herself, lonely and working too hard. Ursula and Bess hadn't always been this close. Bess's adolescence had been a battlefield. Bess challenged Ursula's political views and called her out on her relentless ambition. Achieving is the most important thing to you. It's more important than love, Bess said when she was 15 years old. And wow, Ursula had felt that comment like a slap to the face. Bess has mellowed as she's gotten older. She approved of Ursula's vote against confirming Stone Cavendish as a Supreme Court justice. And when Ursula announced her bid for the presidency a short while later, Bess joined the campaign, courting Gen Z voters. But the development that brought mother and daughter closer, the event that finally made them friends, was Ursula's defeat on Election Day. Ursula had been stunned when first Florida and then Ohio swung for her opponent, Fred Page. Ursula de Guernsey and Fred Page weren't that dissimilar. Fred was a centrist who leaned a little left, and Ursula a centrist who gravitated a bit right. But they agreed on more than they disagreed on, and their debates had been civil, even collegial. Ursula felt she could afford to be nice to Fred. She hadn't run a single attack ad, because she was dead certain that she was going to win. All of the polls had her ahead by 3 to 5 points. Her campaign had outspent Fred's campaign by 20%. Bayer Burkhart, who served as Ursula's shadow campaign manager, assured her daily that a de Guernsey presidency was a lock. So what had happened? All Ursula can come up with is that when people were alone in the voting booth, they couldn't bring themselves to vote for a woman. The problem wasn't Ursula. It was American society. Of course, Ursula harbored plenty of private fears, that ultimately she wasn't likable, that the country saw her naked ambition, her quest for power, that somehow she hadn't projected her desire to serve as effectively as Fred had. Ursula had focused too much on foreign policy and not enough on controlling the pandemic. She had mentioned Notre Dame too many times or Georgetown Law. She had seemed like a braggart when she told Anderson Cooper that she was fluent in French, Spanish, Italian. She rarely attended church, despite her Catholic background. She hadn't seemed maternal enough, or like a devoted enough wife. So much more was expected of a female candidate. It didn't matter. Fred Page had won fair and square. Ursula gave a beautiful concession speech wishing Fred the very best and encouraging her supporters to celebrate his victory. She spent the next 2 days in their house in South Bend in a numb fog,
while Jake and Bess dealt with the news vans lined up on LaSalle Street. At night, Ursula would lie on the couch, clicking among the news outlets, listening to everyone's surprised reactions about the outcome. Bess brought Ursula mugs of tea that she didn't drink and made her sandwiches she didn't eat. Bess covered Ursula with a blanket at night and kissed her mother's temple.
"I'm proud of you," Bess said. "You're taking time to process. You aren't making excuses. You aren't blaming anyone. It takes an extraordinary person to handle this kind of loss as graciously as you are."
At these words, Ursula sat up and stretched out her arms. Bess came to her, and finally, Ursula cried. She cried for her broken dreams, dreams she'd nurtured since she was a child. She cried out of embarrassment. She cried for her dead father. She had wanted to make him proud. She cried from exhaustion and bone-deep weariness. She had given the campaign everything she had, nearly 2 full years of her life, trips to 43 states, bus rides, flights, hotel conference rooms. How many women, not to mention girls, had told her she was inspiring? How many virtual fundraisers had she attended where she had given some variation of her platform speech straight up the fairway? She spoke out for common sense politics, against extremist agendas. Ursula would be a moderate, clear-eyed president who would use her intellect and her excellent judgment to govern. She cried because she had been rejected, plain and simple.
"It hurts," she told Bess. "It really hurts."
"I know, Mama, but that's okay," Bess said. "Pain means you're growing."
The call came 3 weeks later, while Ursula was still convalescing, still dismantling her campaign, and still working as a United States senator from Indiana. It was Fred Page. He asked Ursula to serve in his cabinet, Attorney General. This was, needless to say, unexpected. Indeed, unprecedented. And it wasn't just a good guy Fred Page promotional stunt. It wasn't a nod to unity. Fred said, "You're the most accomplished lawyer I know. I would trust you with a job above and beyond any other candidate on my list."
Yes, Ursula thought. He's right. I would be the best at this job.
Ursula told Fred she'd consider it, and she called her executive coach, Jeannie. After an hours-long conversation, Ursula and Jeannie reached some conclusions. Ursula didn't want to be attorney general. She didn't want to stay in politics at all. When her senatorial term was up, she would return to private life. She wanted to go back into mergers and acquisitions. She wanted to live in New York City. She would do both, she decided. After she hung up with Jeannie, she went to the kitchen where she found Jake walking in with the pizza from Barnaby's.
"We have to talk," she said.
"Jeannie and I decided."
"You and Jeannie decided? You didn't bother to ask me what I thought? Because I don't matter. Because you have no consideration for me or for this so-called family. Bess and I have always bent to your will, and now your will is to be an attorney in New York, and you think I'm just going to, what, pick up and move my life there? I'm not, Ursula. I'm staying here."
Ursula had laughed. "I'm not staying here one day longer than I have to. South Bend is the last place I want to end up."
Jake stared at her.
"I should have stood up to you long ago. Do you know why I didn't? Because I have always believed that you were special. But I'm not giving in on this. If you go to New York, Ursula, you go alone."
It was an ultimatum. But was he serious? Was Ursula serious? They let the topic drop. Ursula still had a year of her term left, so going anywhere was a moot point. Maybe Ursula was suffering from PTSD. Maybe she would change her mind and decide that it would be nice to stay in the Bend with her mother and Jake's parents nearby. Or maybe Ursula and Jake would finally get divorced. While they were dating, they had broken up a handful of times and seen other people, but they had always gravitated back to each other. In the late 90s, Ursula had had an affair with her associate, Anders Jorgensen. Jake had conducted a one-weekend-a-year affair with a woman named Mallory Blessing for the entirety of their marriage. They had survived all that. Surely they would survive Ursula's presidential loss. Now, it's 4 years later. Fred Page will sail easily into a second term, and Ursula is the managing partner at Hamilton, Laverty, and Smythe, the biggest M&A firm in the country. She bought a two-bedroom apartment on the 78th floor of 436 Park, which is the premier address in Midtown, maybe in all of New York. Ursula lost the presidency and lost her husband, but she's gained a city. She loves the noise, the taxis, the subway, the sushi restaurants that deliver 24 hours, the elegant hotel bars, the doormen, the bodegas with their rainbow of floral bouquets out front. She loves the Cuban coffee place and the Vietnamese food truck. She loves racing down to Soho when she needs something new to wear. She loves the FDNY. She loves the guys who drive the horse carriages in Central Park. She loves the Upper East Side mommies and nannies. She loves the 10-story screens in Times Square and the tugboats on the East River. She loves that while everyone knows who she is, nobody cares, because this city is also home to Alicia Keys, Yoko Ono, Sarah Jessica Parker, people far more exciting than Ursula. Does she wish she had someone to share it with? Yes, she does. Maybe a dating app then, after all? Ursula laughs at herself and calls Jake. She's fully prepared to hear about his fun-filled weekend, sailing on Lake Michigan, meeting his parents for dinner at the South Haven Yacht Club, picking cherries, brunching in Saugatuck. At some point, she's sure Jake will start dating. Ursula will pretend to be supportive, and he'll know she's pretending. When he answers, he says, "You're never going to believe who just called me."
"Who?"
"Cooper Blessing," Jake says. "He has the craziest idea." Cooper Blessing is hosting a bachelor weekend on Nantucket over Labor Day. "Please tell me he's not getting married again," Ursula says. "What will that make it? 7, 8?
6.
Jake says, and no, he's not getting married. It's the opposite. He proposed to this girl named Stacy who was at Goucher when we were at Hopkins. She said no, and now, as part of the work he's doing with his new therapist, he wants to recreate the bachelor weekend, only make it all about the guys. Coop is single, Fraser Dooley is single."
Yes, Ursula read about Fraser and Anna Dooley's divorce in People.
Anna walked with $280 million. And Ursula had thought fleetingly, the way one does, about dating Fraser Dooley.
"And you're single," Ursula says.
"I shouldn't say it's all about the guys, because Leland Gladstone is coming too," Jake says. "She was with us the first year."
"Wow," Ursula says. "That's going to be a veritable who's who."
Leland Gladstone is the founder of the huge women's lifestyle blog Leland's Letter, and she was recently chosen as one of Time magazine's most influential people of the year. Leland had been plenty influential in Ursula's life. She wrote an article in Leland's Letter entitled, "Same Time Next Year, Can It Save Modern Marriage?" which had been Ursula's first hint about Jake and Mallory.
"Won't it be difficult for you?" Ursula asks. "Going back to
Mal's cottage?" Jake says.
He sighs.
"I don't know, Ursula. Probably. I'd rather not get into a big fight about it. I just got off the phone with Coop, and I thought I'd let you know that I'll be on Nantucket next weekend."
"You're letting me know now,
But not the 28 years that you went to see Mallory.
Ursula, we aren't doing this.
Right, Ursula says. Well, please give everyone my best.
Oh, I will.
And report back.
Of course, Sully.
She smiles at the nickname. Come see me sometime. I miss you.
That's sweet of you to say. Talk next week.
They hang up, and Ursula presses her phone to her heart and stares out at the city beneath her. It's dark enough now that lights are starting to come on. Back to Nantucket for Labor Day. It sounds like fun, actually. And Ursula half wishes she'd been invited. She pours herself a glass of wine, orders up her lobster and burrata from Marea, and downloads the Fire Pink app on her phone. She will create an online dating profile. Ursula de Guernsey, age 56. This is going to hurt, Ursula thinks. But that's okay. Pain means she's growing. Link.
So it's okay with you if we invade the cottage? Uncle Cooper asks.
Yeah, of course, Link says. When Uncle Coop said he was planning to head up to Nantucket for the weekend, Link was afraid he'd be expected to go along, and that was the last thing he wanted to do. He'd flown back to the island over the week of the 4th of July, when he'd hung out with his friends from high school and even hooked up with his ex-girlfriend, Nicole, the one who ditched him on day 6 of her Italian semester abroad. While it had been fun, it also made Link unbearably sad. Link missed his mother every second of every day. But when he was on Nantucket, the memories were everywhere, especially in the cottage where Mallory had raised him for 18 years. Mallory was present everywhere he looked. Her books were on the shelves. Her favorite green pans were in the kitchen cabinets. The quilt she made out of Link's old t-shirts was smoothed across his bed. Link could see the spot on the front deck where Mallory used to sit when she watched Link and his friends swimming, or when she drank her wine as the sun went down. Mallory and Link had their usual seats at the narrow harvest table, Link at the head, Mallory next to him in the seat closest to the kitchen, because she was often up to get extra napkins or more ice or second helpings for Link. They had their designated spots on the sofa. Link would do his homework. Mallory would grade papers. On Sunday, they watched football. His mother was a Baltimore Ravens fan, which he teased her about relentlessly. Swim in a little, please. Link! Lincoln Dooley, swim in! Did you brush your teeth? Where are you with your history project? Want a kayak? We'll be back in an hour, then I'll drive you to Dylan's. Did you put on sunscreen? Why the long face, handsome? Talk to Mama. Call your father, please. He's been texting me, and I'm afraid he's going to send drones next. There's a card from your grandparents on the counter. I bet it has money in it. You know what makes everything better? Guacamole. I will never be disappointed if you strike out swinging. That means you tried. My 8th period class was a bitch today. Come give your mom a hug. You will never, ever understand how much I love you. Until you have children of your own, and then every word I've ever said will make perfect sense. Link is relieved that the weekend Uncle Coop is planning is just for old people. Link's father is flying in from Seattle. Leland is coming from New York, and Jake McLeod is traveling to the island from South Bend, Indiana. It's supposed to be a reunion of some weekend that happened before Link was born. Link doesn't ask too many questions lest he get roped in. Jake McLeod, though, has always intrigued him. When Mallory was dying, she asked Link to call Jake, and Jake and his daughter Bess had left the Ursula de Guernsey campaign so that Jake could come say goodbye to Mallory. He brought a guitar and sang to her. Link and Bess McLeod had taken a walk on the beach, and Link said,
I feel like something's going on that I don't understand.
Bess said, My dad told me Mallory is an old friend of his.
Oh, Link said.
Bess had laughed. Do they think we're naive? They're more than friends.
Are they?
Link said.
I've never heard my mom mention his name before, and I would have remembered that. Your family is a very big deal.
My mother is a very big deal, Bess said. My dad and I are just infantry soldiers.
She picked up a coag shell.
Look,
Link smiled. You don't get to the beach much?
Bess examined the inside of the shell, the swirls of blue and purple. Wampum, what used to be traded like money. I'm taking this home.
They kept walking.
I like thinking that my dad had something of his own, a secret friendship or whatever. Or maybe they're in love. Maybe they've been in love all these years.
Maybe, Link said. The thought was, frankly, absurd. Link won't lie. He's psyched to have his uncle's place in Georgetown to himself for the weekend. It's a bachelor's paradise. The townhouse on Q Street is 3 stories tall with a finished media room in the basement, and it's decorated like something out of a design magazine. The whole house is done in black and white with pops of color. In the living room, there's a curvy flame orange sofa and 2 electric lime green cup chairs. There's a sweeping staircase with a curved black banister. Coop has huge abstract paintings and modern sculpture on pedestals. It's real art. He goes to the galleries and gets into complicated negotiations with the owners. And then there are antiques scattered throughout. Some of the pieces are from Link's grandparents' house in Baltimore, and some are from the far-flung countries Coop has visited. There's a chess set from India that resides permanently in the sunny breakfast nook with windows that overlook the back courtyard. And every morning when there's time, Coop and Link play. Link has gotten pretty good. Link is thinking about having a party. Just some of the other interns from Brookings and his fraternity brother, Woj, from USC, who's working on Capitol Hill this summer, and who knows a crazy amount of smart and beautiful women. It won't be a full-blown banger. The last thing he wants is to trash Coop's place. But he's thinking about some good people and good whiskey. Coop has a wine and whiskey cellar tucked behind the home gym in the basement, out back in the courtyard. He'll pick up some tacos and banh mi, and play some music and generally flex like the place is his own. Before Coop leaves on Friday morning, he hands Link $300, because that's the kind of awesome uncle he is. Link spends his entire walk to work reminding himself that he has to be a responsible adult and not act like a kid in a movie whose parents are away for the weekend. He'll cut the party off at 50 people, 60 max. But when Link gets to the office and starts firing off texts, Party at my house tonight, 8 p.m. He gets a rude awakening. It's a holiday weekend, the last before people go back to college, graduate school, etc., and everyone is leaving town. Woj is going to Fenwick Island. The other interns are heading to Dewey, Ocean City, Cape May. His buddy Oliver is going home to his parents' house on the eastern shore of Maryland and asks if Link wants to go with him. My dad has a sailboat, Oliver says, and my parents are having a cocktail party on Sunday with a tent and a Dixieland band. It'll be fun. Sailing, cocktails, a Dixieland band? It does sound kind of fun, but it's not what Link had in mind. If he wanted to be on the water, at the beach, he would have gone with his uncle. He wants city life. I think I'll stay put. Thanks, man, Link says. His idea for the weekend instantly changes. He'll just hang out at the house, playing loud music on Coop's state-of-the-art sound system. He'll watch movies in the home theater. He'll sip the whiskey and cognac alone.
He was raised an only child. He can entertain himself. But once Link gets home from work and takes a shower, the city is a smoking griddle. Why did he not go to the beach? He can't settle down. He feels like a friendless loser, sitting home alone. He should go out. He will go out. He remembers his mother's story about going to Nantucket when she was his age without knowing a soul. "Honestly," she said, "it was liberating. I was in control of my future." He heads to a place he and Woj sometimes went called Roofers Union in Adams Morgan, and he finds it pumping. There are people his age drinking and laughing at the tables on the street, and there's a line of young, beautiful people snaking out the door. He waits his turn, presents his ID to the bouncer, and heads inside. He goes to the upstairs bar. It's normally a little less crazy than the one downstairs. There are three free seats at the far end, and beyond those sits a girl with dark hair and glasses, absorbed in her phone. She has a glass of wine in front of her. Is she alone? Link gives her a couple seats as a buffer, orders a Stoli tonic with a twist of lemon, and after his drink arrives and he's had a sip, he glances over. At the same time, she looks up at him. He knows her. It's... "Oh my God," she says. "You're..." "Yeah," he says. "Wait, this is weird. I was just thinking about you." It's Bess McLeod. This is surreal. Although Link has just learned that this phenomenon has a name, where you think about someone and then, out of the blue, they appear. "My dad went to Nantucket with your uncle and your dad," Bess said. "He just texted to say he landed." "That's crazy," Link says. He drinks in the sight of Bess McLeod. She's just as pretty as he remembers. Nerdy pretty, with glasses and hair that hangs in her face a little. "Are you waiting for someone?" Link asks. Bess rolls her eyes. "I'm supposed to be on a Bumble date, but the guy is stuck on the metro." She holds up her phone. "It says he's 16 minutes away." Link slides down the bar next to her. "I can hang with you for 16 minutes, he says. "Then when your boyfriend gets here, I'll leave quietly." Bess laughs. "He's not my boyfriend," she says. "I don't even know him. He's a lobbyist for the alcohol industry." "A lobbyist?" Link says. "Legal bribery." "Exactly," Bess sighs. "I normally stay away, but..." "But the dude is probably good-looking and rolling in cash," Link thinks. "Looks like I have 16 minutes to try and lure you away from the dark side," he says. "I'm working for Brookings, domestic policy. I analyze the impact of policy decisions on the least served among us and suggest ways to make them more effective."
"I work in nonprofits," Bess says.
"Sexy," Link says.
"Yeah, as sexy as being a producer for public television," Bess says.
"Hey, do you still have that shell?" Link asks.
"That Quahog shell that you found on the beach in Nantucket?"
Bess sips her wine and nods. "It's on my dresser, actually."
"No, seriously?
Swear to God."
"And did you..."
"Did I what?"
The thing that Link wants to ask might take another drink, but the clock is ticking. The lobbyist will probably show up with his American Express Obsidian card in 11 minutes.
"Did you ever ask your dad what was going on between him and my mom?"
Bess's green eyes find Link's from behind her glasses. Her eyebrows raise.
"I did."
She swivels her head to take in the raucous bar scene beyond them.
"Do you maybe want to go someplace quieter and I can tell you about it?"
Link laughs.
"What about your date?"
Bess checks her phone.
"The pin hasn't moved. He's stuck on the metro. I'll cancel him and we can go over to Lapis for Afghan food. Does that sound okay?"
Link doesn't care if they go to McDonald's. There's no way he's going to miss a chance to sit across the table from this beautiful, nerdy girl and learn something new about his mother.
"Sounds great," he says.
Leland. When Leland's jet-blue flight from JFK touches down on Nantucket, she looks out the window and takes note of the rows and rows of private planes, including an impressive jet with the frayed edge coffee logo on the side. She experiences a childish burst of excitement. Frey is here. She pulls down the front of her denim cloche hat and puts on oversized sunglasses. There are some young women farther back on the plane who recognized Leland at the gate in New York. They asked for a selfie with her, which she indulged even though she's more than over it. But Leland's brand and Leland's letter are all about women lifting up other women, so she can hardly refuse anyone. She hurries down the plane stairway and practically runs across the tarmac. Nantucket Island. The name speaks of wealth and entitlement, though to Leland, the idea of Nantucket is inextricably tied to memories of the best friend she has ever had in her life, Mallory Blessing. The first time Leland set foot on this island was Labor Day weekend, 1993. She had been so young, only 24 years old. In those days, she lived on the Upper East Side and worked as an editorial assistant at Bard and Scribe. Leland had thought she was special. She emulated the lockjaw of the Vassar girls she worked with. She dyed her hair pink. She bought all her clothes from thrift shops in the village, except for a stiff leather jacket from Trash and Vaudeville that she spent a whopping $900 on, because Ray Goodman himself said that Leland reminded him of a young Patti Smith. When Leland came to Nantucket on that first trip, she had behaved atrociously. She kissed Frey, Fraser Dooley, her first love, in the back seat of Mallory's car. But then, once they got to the bar, she bumped into an acquaintance from New York, Kip Sudbury, whose father was in commercial real estate and who had a yacht at his disposal, and Leland left Mallory and Frey and Cooper without a word of explanation. She ditched them. It made her cringe to remember it now. The only excuse she had was youth. She returned to Nantucket a few years later with her girlfriend, the novelist Fiella Rejet, Fifi, but things hadn't gone much better. That was early on in Leland and Fifi's relationship, back when Leland was still threatened by Fifi's fame and was alternately possessive and bitter. It didn't help that Fifi shamelessly flirted with Mallory, maybe as a way of reminding her who in the couple had the allure, the power. Leland should have laughed off Fifi's behavior. Mallory was so hopelessly straight that she would only have seen the sexual overtures as Fifi being friendly. But instead, Leland had lashed out by tearing Mallory down. Mallory had overheard Leland insulting her, and the weekend had been ruined. Leland had once read an interview with Toni Morrison where the author said she regretted a third of her life. Leland's percentage was running a bit higher than that. The last time Leland had been on Nantucket was 4 years earlier, when Mallory was dying. She had skin cancer that she thought she'd successfully treated, but it metastasized to her brain. It wasn't fair. Mallory was a good person, a mom and a teacher, a reader and a thinker, the most generous friend in what she was willing to accept and forgive. It should have been Leland in the bed. Leland deserved little in the way of mercy from the universe. Her life had been a cakewalk by comparison. She had always been free to be self-absorbed. She gets a text. It's Coop.
I'm out front in Mal's Jeep.
Leland's fellow New Yorkers are all looking very self-consciously Nantuckety in their faded red pants and straw hats. Leland has made a concession to the season by wearing Eileen Fisher, the queen of black linen. Unlike these weekend warriors, Leland feels she belongs here because while they all check their Ubers, she has someone waiting for her out front in a Seen Better Days Jeep. The girls who approach Leland at the gate in JFK are right behind her. She can hear them checking the address of their Airbnb, and then one of them says, "Oh my God, look!" I think that's Fraser Dooley.
Leland raises her eyes. Sure enough, Frey is walking out of the private jet terminal wearing his usual uniform of white t-shirt, jeans, Ray-Ban Wayfarers, and a messenger bag strapped across his chest. His blondish-gray hair is long and unkempt. The hair is his signature. It's what makes him the most recognizable CEO in the country. When he raises his arm and calls out, "Lee!" it's all she can do to stop herself from running into his arms.
"I'm jealous AF right now," one of the girls stage whispers. "He knows Leland Gladstone."
Leland is tempted to turn around and say, "He was my boyfriend in high school." That would have given them something to talk about. But Leland is well beyond defining herself by any relationship she's had with a man.
"Hey, Frey," she says with a coy smile.
They embrace and kiss, gestures of fondness that Leland missed during the pandemic years. Frey smells like some kind of heavenly, expensive aftershave. He's so delicious that Leland would like to take a bite of him, a reaction that thoroughly surprises her. Cooper honks the horn. "Let's go, kids," he says. Frey gallantly takes Leland's bag and tosses it into the back of the Jeep. Then he opens the passenger door so Leland can hitch her skirt and climb in. She sees her fans gawking from the sidewalk, and she can't help herself. She gives a four-finger wave.
"Woohoo!" Coop shouts.
He turns up the radio, which is playing the top 500 rock songs of all time in honor of the holiday weekend, and number 426 is Van Halen's "I'll Wait." It has been a very long time since Leland has listened to Van Halen. She sticks with female artists, Alison Krauss, Nora Jones, Lizzo, and the song delivers her right back to Deep Dean Road in 1984. She and Mallory are freshmen in high school, and Cooper and Frey are juniors. Even though Leland has been around both boys all her life, they attain a new mystique that year because they get their driver's licenses. Cooper is the good boy, clean-cut, preppy, and Frey is the bad boy. Frey's hair is long. He wears red parachute pants and walks around with a permanent scowl, flipping his bangs out of his eyes. Leland finds him mesmerizing, but she doesn't tell Mallory because Frey is like a brother to her and, ew. Frey is the arbiter of everyone's musical tastes. He listens to Van Halen, Twisted Sister, Honeymoon Suite. Frey lives with his grandparents around the corner on Edgevale, but he's always at the Blessing House with Coop. And because of this, Leland and Mallory start spending all their time there as well. Leland and Mallory ask Coop and Frey for rides, even though there's nowhere to go. Downtown Inner Harbor is a destination, but the shopping is touristy and expensive, and Fells Point is one bar after another that they can't get into. Still, they beg to be allowed to ride around in the back seat, anything to get them out of the house. They're sick of watching movies in Leland's basement rec room and listening to records. They both know there's life out there somewhere, and they're ready for it.
"Sorry," Coop says. "Riding around with my little sister and her best friend isn't my idea of a good time. It's babysitting."
At the end of October, Coop starts dating a girl named Alana Bratton, who goes to Bryn Mawr. Alana is beautiful, she's a senior, and when she snaps her fingers, Coop does her bidding. The person who is left out is Frey. His buddy has ditched him for a girl. At the beginning of November, Mallory gets the flu. Leland is under strict orders from her parents, Jerry and Steve, as well as from the Blessings, to stay away from the Blessing House until the contagious period is over. Leland's parents are leaving for the weekend on a leaf-peeping trip through the horse country of Virginia, and Leland thinks how unfair it is that she will now have the house to herself but nobody to enjoy the freedom with. It's as she's watching Coop pull out of the driveway from her bedroom window, he's probably off to pick up Alana, that Leland gets the idea to call Frey.
Mal is sick and my parents are away, Leland says. Wanna come over and use the hot tub? My dad has a fridge full of beer in the garage.